Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. The Civil War never ends. 165 years after the first shots were fired at Fort Sumter, Americans continue to grapple with what the war meant and, of course, how the story of our nation's bloodiest conflict is told. After all, more than 700,000 Americans died during the four-year war. One of the ways the Civil War story has not been told is through the voices and experiences of free people of color. When the war began in 1861, most black people were enslaved. Even so, nearly 500,000 were free, spread across the North and the South alike. Historian Warren Miltier has written a new book, Out of This Strife Will Come Freedom, that explores the experiences and influence of free people of color before, during, and after the war. Warren Miltier is with me today to discuss his book and the eternal tug of war over Civil War history. Warren, welcome to Charlotte Talks.
Thanks for having me.
You write in the book that your grandmother set you on this path. How so?
Yeah, so my grandmother was a source of family stories. She was a source of education very early in my life. And so as far as family stories are concerned and how they connect to this book, I'm a descendant of free people of color. And so my grandmother, to a certain extent, is a link between me and the generation of people that were free people of color. So my grandmother's grandparents were free people of color. So these were people who were free before 1861, before the beginning of the Civil War, who were also people of color. And so she knew these people intimately and was able to tell me little bits and pieces about their stories. And of course, I was able to then take that information and build stories about free people of color by going to archives, libraries, things of that nature, in order to flesh out what was it like to be a free person of color during the Civil War and even before.
And you partially answered this question, but I think there was a variety, or I know from reading your book, there was a variety of people and definitions of free people of color. So for our audience, what do you mean when you say free people of color?
Right. Yeah. So free people of color was a term that was commonly used, especially in the 19th century, to describe a wide variety of people. These were primarily people of either African or Native American ancestry, maybe some mixture of both. The term was also used for the small group of Asian descended people in many parts of the United States, especially those people who came from what we would consider South Asia, so places like India, and even occasionally for people from China were considered people of color or colored people in the 19th century.
So I think, again, and this is much of what your book is about, it shows how we have oftentimes missed the history or dumbed down the history, oversimplified the history, even in defining who is what in these scenarios.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I think that it's easy for us to take our ideas about the present and apply them to the past. And so I think that's often what happens when we're discussing this time period and discussing this particular group of people. We think that the racial order of today fits perfectly with the racial order of the 19th century, and that's not necessarily the case.
And the premise of this book is to explain how these free people of color helped shape the notions of being a free citizen, of having equal opportunity, ideas that many enslaved people barely had time for or could even imagine. Looking back, how effective do you think the free people of color were at achieving that?
I think looking back long term, they were very effective in shaping what it meant to be free and also what possibilities existed under that status of being a free person. So, in the time period in which I'm writing, especially the period before, immediately before the Civil War, free people of color across the nation generally were dealing with some level of legal discrimination when it came to their rights. So those limits could look like anything from restrictions on the right to vote to them not being able to ride in public transportation to maybe not being placed in the same area of a church. So they would have to sit in the back while white people would sit in the front. And so these were things that came to the attention of free people of color very early on, well before the war started. And many of them were unwilling to accept this particular situation where their rights were not equal to those of other people around them, particularly the white people around them.
And how did they fight back? Because you have the resistance that you're talking about, but there is inherently danger in resistance.
Right. So, I mean, they're fighting back in a variety of different ways. Some of it is lawsuits. So they will sue because they think the discrimination is not fair or is unconstitutional or if it doesn't fit with the state laws. They protest, they organize. Some people will be familiar with the sit-in movements of the 20th century civil rights movement. Well, there were sit-ins in that time period. There were people who were getting on public transportation and being thrown off and protesting being thrown off and filing lawsuits to res in response to that. They're creating organizations to respond to this kind of thing. So they're going through a variety of different paths, trying to find a way to make their push for rights stick. And it could be things like what I've just described. Some of it might be things that are more subtle. It might be simply trying to get around the laws that exist in some way, shape, or form, saying, well, that law doesn't actually apply to me. It says one thing, but I'm not really the person that this law is targeting. And that would be more of an approach for somebody, especially in the South, a place where by this time the laws have gotten particularly extreme. And so free people of color have to look for less obvious ways to protect themselves in the face of discrimination and a world in which rights are not guaranteed to all free people.
That's the voice of Warren Miltier. He is the author of Out of This Strife Will Come Freedom: Free People of Color and the Fight for Equal Rights in the Civil War Era. You come back time and again to how little attention has been paid to this population. Why have they been ignored for so long?
Well, I think part of it is that a lot of people don't know they existed, that there were free people of color. Or if they do know, many people assume that free people of color only lived in the northern states, so in places like Massachusetts and Pennsylvania and New York. I think another issue that free people of color face as far as their story being told is that their story tends to be combined with that of the enslaved population. They're looked at as kind of a sub-segment of that population instead of a distinct population. And while many free people of color did have familial relationships across the line of freedom and slavery, legally their situation was quite different. And in some cases, there were free people of color who had very distant ties to slavery, if any at all. And so, they didn't necessarily see themselves as being the same as the enslaved population, but many people looking from the outside have looked at them that way and written about them in that way.
Given those differences, and we're generalizing here, but given those differences, how much empathy was there for the even worse circumstances that obviously the enslaved people faced and lived in?
I think it varied. So some free people of color were very responsive to the harsh situation that the enslaved population dealt with. And you do have some free people of color, both in the North and the South, that helped the enslaved population in a variety of ways. It could be just, lending them in a hand of lending them a hand in a time of need. But also, you do have free people of color who are active in the anti-slavery movement, who are helping runaways get to freedom, things of that nature. But then there are also, I think, a lot of free people of color who are primarily concerned with slavery because slavery is a threat to them. So they see slavery's existence as a problem because it gives their political opponents and the people who are targeting them a rationale to say that you're not equal, that you don't deserve certain rights. And so, as long as slavery exists, they see that their rights in the United States are going to be limited. Then there is a small minority of free people of color who are slaveholders. This would be primarily in the South by the time we're talking about in the 1850s and 1860s. And so some of these people who are free people of color own, one or two individuals. Sometimes people own family members, and that's one situation. But there are free people of color who are planters in places like Louisiana and South Carolina and Mississippi who have significant numbers of people that they are holding in bondage, and they are using those people in order to make a profit.
And the free people of color are, in a way, in no man's land because they're not part of the enslaved population, and yet they're only accepted on a limited basis, if at all, by the white population. How did that psychological strain show itself?
Well, I think it varied. So I think for some free people of color, though not being part of one group or another allowed them to kind of create an identity of their own. And so you see that with certain populations where being a free person of color is really important to them and they define themselves that way. And in some cases, that identity continues on well beyond the Civil War, once slavery is eliminated, they still see themselves as somehow distinct. Other individuals don't necessarily think that way and see themselves as not just having common cause with the enslaved population, but see themselves as very much a part of a larger collective, I guess you could say. And then there's also a minority of free people of color who, I think this is something that would be hard for a lot of people to understand, who are basically one step away from being considered white. And so these are people that I think today, if they were living, for the most part, would just be automatically accepted as white. But because of the way that race was constructed in the 19th century, it had a lot to do with who knew you, who knew your family. And so if people knew that you had an ancestor that could be identified as a person of color, they considered you one too.
We are going to leave it right there for the moment. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to have much more on the Civil War's untold history coming up next on Charlotte Talks right here on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. My guest today is author and historian Warren Miltier. His latest book is Out of This Strife Will Come Freedom, Free People of Color and the Fight for Equal Rights in the Civil War Era. And Warren, you were just speaking about people, free people of color who could perhaps have passed for white. I'm wondering how much the circumstances worked the other way, where free people of color had to prove their identity and their freedom.
Yeah, so that's definitely an issue. where free people of color could potentially be mistaken to be enslaved, or there are people who are claiming free people of color as slaves illegally. So kidnapping, for instance, is an issue throughout the time period before the Civil War and even during the war to some extent, where people who are slave traders or people looking to make a quick profit will kidnap a free person of color and try to enslave that person. And so the main way that free people of color try to protect themselves outside of just fighting back physically or protecting themselves in other ways is to carry free papers. So in some states, free papers were required by law. In other states, they were not, but many people had them. And so these would be documents that would give a description of a free person of color, their physical appearance, how they became free. It might mention who their mother was, because that is also important to your freedom status. And it would have some type of local certification on it, some signatures. You may have to pay for the paper, but this would be something that you would carry around on your person to protect yourself when somebody came and potentially asked you, are you free? Are you slave? Do you have the right to be here?
You mentioned at the start of the show that much of your research and the material in this book comes from archives. How difficult is it to find this information in the archives? And what I mean by that is, how clearly are those population groups defined in the records that you're able to sift through?
It's mixed. So in certain cases, free people of color show up in the records very clearly. They're often denoted as being a free person of color, or the variety of other terms that were used for the individuals of color, may it be black or Negro or mulatto. Those kind of terms will show up in the historical record next to the name of the individual, which says something about how, the people keeping the records thought of these people, that they thought it was necessary to write this information down. In other cases, there is no information denoting the difference. I've seen many records where you wouldn't know that the person was a free person of color. And I've actually seen people make mistakes and assume that because there is no notation that the individual is white when the person was not considered white. And so the way to get around that for me is to get a sense of people in the community, try to identify families, things of that nature. That's where I guess family history and my background in family history was really important in being able to determine who is who.
And you mentioned in the you've mentioned that this is really a realm of the Civil War that has not been dug into to any significant degree. And I'm wondering how much surprise and recognition there is now among Civil War historians as you begin to put this out in the world of here's a new thread to the story.
I mean, I think we'll see what happens with that. But I think there are definitely people who are interested in learning more about this, that, think that this particular angle is important, especially when we connect the story of free people of color to larger issues that people think about when they think about the Civil War, and especially its aftermath, thinking about the Constitutional Amendments, the Civil Rights Act that follows the war, and the way that society changes, people can see the connections between what I'm talking about and these major changes in society.
And you mentioned the family connection, and that's what got you interested in free people of color. At what point did you realize that you had hooked on to something unique and different?
I think probably pretty early on. So I actually got interested in my family history as a kid. And so I think part of the reason that it was interesting was that the story of my family and other families like my family kind of countered these simple narratives of what it meant to be somebody like me in America. And it added a lot more complexity. And I think that complexity kind of drew me in. And as I moved into a more serious career in history, going to college and thinking about these issues and graduate school, that became even more meaningful in driving me to study this group of people and try to give the broader public a better understanding of who these people were and also people in academia.
And were you, at what point did you become interested in the Civil War? In other words, was the war a subject of fascination for you, even before you got into this particular history of it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can, remember reading the first books I ever read about the Civil War. Probably, I must have been like 6 years old or something like that. I grew up in Virginia as well, and so Civil War memory to some extent is all over the place in Virginia. It's in the buildings, it's in the symbols that you see around you. And so the Civil War was definitely something that I always paid attention to, enjoyed reading books about. And once I started my research on free people of color, I found it very important to talk about the Civil War because it was an important moment of change, both for the nation and also for the status of free people of color in the United States. And so I think every book that I've written, this is either fourth or fifth, depending on how you want to count, there's something about the Civil War in there. And so this was an opportunity to write more deeply about that subject.
Now, this book covers the period roughly from the 1850s to the 1870s, as I said, right before and right after the war and the war itself. At what point did free people of color begin to distinguish themselves, begin to be defined as free people of color?
So I think that happens really early on. We start to see references of free people of color in the colonial period as and see them to some extent being looked at as distinct, especially legally. And I mean, if you have the legal status of a free person of color and you that comes with certain rights, and you see other people of color around you who don't have those rights, it's going to be meaningful pretty, I think it's very obvious for them that their situation is different. And for the people around them as well, they recognize that that situation is different. And so that legacy just, kind of carries on over the years and the generations and, and it goes through the Civil War and beyond.
You mentioned that all of your books have touched to some degree on this topic. How much of the history of free people of color do you think remains to be told? In other words, do you think you've exhausted this subject?
No, I don't think so. I think there's quite a bit still to learn about this population. There are many parts of the country where there hasn't been a real deep dive into looking at this population and what their lives were like. So I think there's work to be done there. And also, I'm in the process now of trying to synthesize what information I can find about free people of color across the nation. So most of my early work focused on the US South, North Carolina in particular. And since that time, I've broadened out my exploration of free people of color. I've done a lot of research further north, trying to understand the experiences of free people of color there. And some of that research comes out in this book that we're discussing today, but I still have a lot more material to go through and share with people.
That's the voice of Warren Miltier. He is the author of Out of This Strife Will Come Freedom, Free People of Color and the Fight for Equal Rights in the Civil War Era. As we talked about, you've spent a lot of time in the National Archives. What have you learned about how and where to find this information? I'm assuming that as time goes on, you get better and better at this. What are some of the secrets, or the best ways to really glean this information?
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, the National Archives in particular is a great place to find information about free people of color and all kinds of people in the United States. And so, what happened is when I started working on the subject of free people of color, there were some areas where I was having a hard time finding information. And so, going to the National Archives, I discovered or uncovered a record group that other people had used before, but I found particularly useful to discuss free people of color, and that was Civil War pensions. And so Civil War pensions were given to veterans of the war and their spouses and children. And in those pensions, you can read the firsthand testimony of veterans, the spouses, family members, friends who are generally supporting the pension. And that is one place where you actually get the voices of free people of color in certain areas where you won't find them anywhere else. And so that is, I think, one of the major things that drew me to thinking more seriously about free people of color and the Civil War as a big project and not just something that would be a chapter in one of my other books. I knew that this source existed. And so I started looking one place and I just kept going and going and expanding. And since that time, and especially when I started working on this book in a more serious way, I started digging into other collections that the National Archives has. There are just a score of different records about the U.S. military and the various wars that the military is engaged in. Many of the local records for Washington, D.C. are actually held at the National Archives because the national government has played an outsized role in controlling D.C. So, yeah, there's just so much material there. I don't know if anybody in a lifetime could ever even, you know, touch 1% of it. But, yeah, it's amazing.
You mentioned you've looked at North Carolina in depth. How does North Carolina figure into this story?
Yeah, so, I mean, North Carolina plays a really interesting role in the experience of free people of color in the Civil War era. So when we think about the Civil War in particular, the Civil War divided North Carolina in a variety of different ways. Both it divided the people, but it actually divided the geography. So a lot of people will imagine that North Carolina was a Confederate state or state in rebellion during the Civil War. But there were large sections of North Carolina that were actually controlled by the U.S. government and the U.S. military through the majority of the war, especially to the east. And there were also sections of Virginia that were held that many North Carolinians ran to during the war, who didn't want to be involved in the rebellion or wanted to join the U.S. Army's effort to suppress the rebellion. And so free people of color were among the many people who were both leaving the state, trying to go to those U.S. Held areas of Virginia, but they're also, many of them are moving from the interior of the state to the east and finding shelter there as well. So North Carolina's story around free people of color in the war, I think, is really interesting when you dig deep into it.
The book, as we've mentioned a couple times, looks at the war, but it also looks at the period before and immediately after the war. Why did you want to tell those portions of the story along with the war itself?
Yeah, well, I think The earlier time period, so the 1850s chapters of my book, were important because it gives people a sense of the context in which free people of color were living. It's hard to understand what they might be fighting for during the war without knowing what they were going through before the war started. And I think the ending chapter of the book, which focuses on Reconstruction, is also useful because it's there where you can see the results of the war to a certain extent. So free people of color have been advocating for themselves for years, and their advocacy, I would say, overall increases during the war because the war changes the politics of the nation and gives them an opportunity they had never had before. They had a place to finally be heard to a certain extent. They could go and petition the president, petition Congress. And it is in that period where they're starting to take the organizing from the earlier period and apply it. And it is in the Reconstruction period where we start to see changes in the law. We start to see them running for political office as a result of their advocacy and the networks they built during the war. So in order to recognize how the war had an effect, I think it's really important to look at those years after the war too.
And you write about how the free people of color are in many ways role models for what is possible for the newly emancipated people from the South.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Because some free people of color, not all, but some definitely had opportunities in the pre-war period that the enslaved population largely did not have. So you do have free people of color in various parts of the country who are pretty well educated. Some of them are really well educated. I would say they're a significant minority, but they do exist. And so those individuals who have that background, who had been able to obtain a little bit of wealth before the war, were able to take their skills and take their influence and property and things of that nature and turn it into real political power in the post-Civil War moment. And I think to a certain degree, they were able to stand as models and stand as people who aided the newly freed people in their in the process of trying to figure out how to get an education, how to get ahead, how to form networks in a political sense, as well as a social sense. So yeah, that's what I'm thinking there when it comes to free people of color and the formerly enslaved population and their connections during Reconstruction.
We are going to dig into a lot more of this story and the untold history of free people of color during the Civil War. We're speaking with Warren Miltier. His new book is called Out of This Strife Will Come Freedom, Free People of Color, and the Fight for Equal Rights in the Civil War Era. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. Stay with us right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. We're continuing our conversation with historian and author Warren Miltier. His new book is Out of This Strife Will Come Freedom. And Warren, we were just talking about some of the opportunities that free people of color had and how that served as a model for some of the newly emancipated people coming out of the Civil War. And I'm wondering what the end of Reconstruction did to free people of color. We know it essentially reversed any and all progress for the formerly enslaved, but what was the fate of the free people of color?
Yeah, so I think the fate of the free people of color was mixed. Many free people of color had to deal with the same issues that the formerly enslaved people had to deal with. With the gradual end of Reconstruction, so they're seeing their rights once again disappear. Many of them had actually, you know, been in this, you know, years long fight for these rights, only to see them go away. Depending on where you are, there are some free people of color who are still able to push on. So we have to look at the experiences of free people of color nationally. And so what Jim Crow looks like in, you know, Mississippi and Louisiana or here in North Carolina would be a bit different than what that post-Reconstruction period looks like in Massachusetts. And so many of the victories of the Reconstruction period in, say, Massachusetts or Connecticut, people were able to still take advantage of that. And there were people still fighting for, say, school integration in many parts of the North well after the 1870s. So we have that, but there are also some free people of color who decide to turn inward because things didn't quite work out the way they wanted it to. And so they just kind of tried to look back to the past and see what worked in the past. And that may be, you know, containing themselves to certain social networks, playing on that old distinction from the pre-Civil War days. Of course, there are some people who if they can, they choose to cross the so-called colored line and take on identities as white people. And so there are, many white people in the United States today who are descendants of free people of color. And part of that, process took place during the Jim Crow era, when people were willing to give up family and friends in order to find what they saw as opportunity.
The regional differences for the experiences of free people of color, when do you think they were most similar or most equal, for lack of a better term? And when did they become, I guess, so much in contrast? Whereas, when you're talking about Reconstruction, post-Reconstruction, how North is very different from South, do you see that as a continuum or did it fluctuate?
I think it did fluctuate. Probably the most similarity would have been back in the colonial period, where there was slavery in the North and laws that were going to affect free people of color as a result of Northern commitments to slavery. But as time goes on, I think the situation contrasts. Especially when you're looking at the local level and some of the things that free people of color in the North were able to accomplish that came quite late in the South. At the same time, if you're looking at political power, say during the Reconstruction period, there were clearly more people of color in the South who had political power when we're talking about operating as politicians. Operating as representatives of the state legislature, going to Congress, than there were in the northern states. But if you go beyond that and look at what happens later on, then to some extent, things have turned once again when the people in the South don't have the same political prominence that they once had.
And you're talking in this book, writing in this book about differences in rights between the free people of color, between the enslaved, obviously, and then you have the white ruling class. And I'm wondering, how much you think about the fact that so many of these things are still issues, whether it's voting rights, whether it's access to public education, whether it's where you live, all these things continue to roil our society, perhaps in a little different way, but not that far off.
Right. Yeah, no, there are definitely connections. And I think part of the issue is that the problems that free people of color were trying to fix, along with other allies in the Civil War era, especially during Reconstruction, a lot of those issues were not fully dealt with in that time period. And there were a lot of gaps left in the policy. There was a lot of compromise made in order to get things through. One thing that, did get somewhat settled from the Reconstruction period was women's right to vote. So there were women, including free women of color, who were advocating for their right to vote at the same time that men of color would be given the right to vote with the 15th Amendment. And, many of them were disappointed by what happened, and it wasn't until the 20th century where we see the changes in the Constitution that allow women to vote across the nation. But in making a policy during the Reconstruction era in which all people weren't given the right to vote up front, that of course has left us with a lot of issues in immediately after the Reconstruction period, but also today, because we don't actually have a guaranteed right to vote in the United States. It's not explicit in that way. It's more about you can't be denied the right to vote based on X, Y, and Z characteristic. And so, because we have a policy like that, which was written for a certain reason, we still have to deal with some issues around, people's rights. I think all of us would agree today that we are, free in a legal sense, but our rights are not necessarily guaranteed just because we're free. And that is an issue that very much ties to the experience of free people of color that I'm talking about in my book.
As you go through this history and you see the echoes, the similarities of some of the problems, and you also see the grim circumstances of 150, 165 years ago, and other time periods that you study, I'm wondering whether you come away with more of a sense of optimism and resilience, or something that's a little darker in terms of, gosh, very little progress over many, many, many decades.
Yeah, I'd say my view is mixed. I definitely think that the changes that took place in the time period that I'm writing about were important and they were meaningful. Getting rid of slavery was a big deal. You've got to imagine that the people that I'm looking at and the people who are living in American society in the 1860s, those who had been here long enough had seen generation after generation of people enslaved in this country. And many of them took that to be normal. And so it was a seismic change for slavery to end. And I think it's something that we have to take serious and recognize and celebrate the fact that it no longer exists in the way that it did in the 1850s and 1860s in particular. At the same time, yeah, I think we've got a lot of work to do. And I think that some people may have gotten, I guess, a little confused by, you know, the changes of the past and put a little more value in what had changed but had not changed enough in a certain sense. And so I think we, you know, we always need to look back and think about why were the laws that we're dealing with today created, what compromises were made, and are there things that we need to fix in order to make our society better?
That's the voice of Warren Miltier. His new book is called Out of This Strife Will Come Freedom. An interesting point you make is that the stories or the history and the stories that follow the Civil War lump these populations together. And I'm talking about free people of color and enslaved people. And one of the examples you use is the 54th Massachusetts, which was featured in the movie Glory. And in the movie, there are numerous stories of formerly enslaved people who are now going into battle. The facts, though, are a little bit different. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the facts are that the majority of the members of the 54th Massachusetts were free people of color and not people who had been enslaved. And so the film, to a certain extent, is, I say, putting the experiences of free people of color in competition with those of the enslaved population by choosing to downgrade the stories of free people of color and then promote a mythic version of the 54th Massachusetts. I can understand why that's the case, but at the same time, I think it does some harm because it, number one, I don't think these stories should be in competition. I think we can learn about free people of color, understand their lives, appreciate their lives without saying, oh, well, you know, this is the story of the enslaved population, and we need to center that over free people of color for whatever purpose. I just don't think that's necessary. And I say that as somebody who's a descendant of both populations. So I care very much about the story of the enslaved population as well as those of free people of color. But I don't think it's taking us anywhere by downgrading their situation. And also, you know, there's a lot to be learned from just the truth and an accurate telling of history and understanding how was the 54th actually created, who were the people who were pushing for its organization, who were supporting the 54th and other regiments like it financially, what issues were they facing that were actually commonplace amongst the soldiers. So that's what I would have to say about Glory. I think it's a really interesting movie, very entertaining. But it does have some issues as far as accuracy.
Which is fitting because we as a country have some issues about accuracy when it comes to history. And I'm wondering how you think the current state, and this really, you can bring current politics into it because politics isn't everything. But what I'm asking you is right now, collectively, how would you grade our understanding of Civil War era history?
I think it's not great right now. We have a lot of problems with Civil War history. A big issue is the Lost Cause and the effects of the Lost Cause on people's understanding of the war. There are a lot of, I would say, myths that people believe and things that just aren't true. But there's also a lot of framing of the war itself that is illogical and doesn't make a lot of sense.
Give me an example.
This is very controversial, but I'll say it anyways. And that is that the Confederate States of America was an actual country. So people take that for granted that it was an actual country, although it did not have recognition from any other country in the world, surely did not have recognition from the United States of America. And there are a few scholars who've looked into this. And after the war, the Supreme Court actually ruled that it was not a legitimate country, that secession was not legal and it could not actually happen. Yeah, that's something we take for granted. And it doesn't actually make any sense. How do you have a civil war between two countries? That's totally illogical. I'm sure I'll get some pushback on that, but hey, it is what it is. And so that's definitely something that is reflected in my writing. You will look read my book and recognize that I don't give the so-called Confederate States of America the recognition that it never earned.
And for people who are new to this subject, which is going to be almost everyone, particularly the aspect of free people of color, as you said, but the larger Civil War context that we're talking about, what do you hope are one or two things that they take away from this book?
Well, I mean, one, I definitely hope that they see how the struggles of free people of color many years before the war, this to a certain extent, that the Jim Crow that they had to deal with in the pre-Civil War period helped to both shape the Jim Crow period afterwards, but also helped to give people ideas and inspiration for how to fight back against inequality in the United States. So I think that that is really important. And then also, I think just thinking a little bit bigger, that we have to recognize that the Civil War was about the people. It wasn't just about the military leaders. They're, of course, extremely important, but that the war had real impact on real individuals and shaped the lives of this, the person that is least recognized in our society, or was recognized in our society at that particular time, that this war shaped their lives to and meant something to them.
I think that's a good place to leave it. Warren Miltier, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Warren Miltier is a professor of history at George Washington University, and his new book is called Out of This Strife Will Come Freedom: Free People of Color and the Fight for Equal Rights in the Civil War Era. For Mike Collins, I'm Eric Spanberg. Thanks for listening to Charlotte Talks right here on WFAE.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. The producer is Chris Jones. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.